Hey there, I'm Marjorie Stiegler, and you're listening to the Career Prescription Podcast, where we tackle the important things they don't teach you in medical school, like how to treat your career like the business it really is, with strategies to accelerate the kind of success that you want. Because you deserve a career you love and a career that loves you back. Are you ready? Let's get into it. So today I'm really excited to have on the show Dr. Patrick Toomey, who is a pharmacovigilance physician, but has had a long and diverse career really in medicine and in pharma. And so I'm really just excited to have him on the show today to answer all the many questions that I get asked that I don't know because that's not my area. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me, Marjorie. I'm really excited to be here as well. Definitely get a lot of questions about pharmacovigilance from folks, and it's really exciting to be able to be on your platform to be able to sort of hopefully answer a lot of the questions that people have.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we can, since I know some of my audience will know you well from a lot of the insightful comments that you give in on some of the forums and social media and so forth. But for people who maybe don't know you, can you give a little bit of an introduction about you, your sort of traditional medical training and your early career?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So yeah, my background, I'm Patrick Toomey, as you mentioned. My background has been in internal medicine. So I did my residency in internal medicine, practiced as an internist for a couple of years, but just never really loved internal medicine. I was fine. I wasn't burnt out. I liked the clinic. It was okay. I enjoyed my patients. I think I was a good doctor. no issues there, but I just felt like, you know, I wasn't really making a huge impact on medicine being in the clinic day to day. And my background before going to medical school was as a chemist. And so I was always kind of interested in that pharmacology space. And a mentor of mine in medical school, or sorry, residency, had told me about a clinical pharmacology fellowship training that was available. At the time, I was active duty Army. I had done the HPSP program for medical school and was working active duty at the time. And the Army had a pretty good training program. So I applied for that and went back and did a two-year fellowship in clinical pharmacology and really just fell in love with that. So that's a whole nother topic probably.
Yeah, that's cool.
But in a nutshell, clinical pharmacologists that are physicians usually run our phase one and phase two healthy volunteer studies and do things like food effect studies and PK, pharmacokinetic studies and thorough QT studies and all of that. So I trained in that area and actually worked as a clinical pharmacologist and clinical development lead in infectious disease programs for the Army for about 6 years before finally, when I got out of the Army, decided that working in the clinic full time. At the time in the Army, I was doing both sort of like a traditional academic type position, like seeing clinic once or twice a week and then doing clinical trials and clinical development the rest of the time. But I really fell in love with product development and the pharmaceutical side of things. And so when I got out of the Army, I applied to jobs in pharma and eventually landed at Genentech, which is part of Roche, living in the Bay Area, initially as a clinical pharmacologist there for about a year and a half, but then transitioned over to drug safety, which for Genentech, we actually divided into early development. So the sort of translational coming into the clinic for the first time, first in human studies through about phase two, and then late stage development, stage two and beyond. And so I landed in early development where I've been ever since. So for about 4 years now, I've been working in the early development drug safety space.
That's fantastic. And since you have mentioned that, I want to kind of pause for a second on the clinical pharmacology fellowship that you did. A lot of people ask if they need additional training in order to make a transition from being a physician, you know, in the clinic, either academics or clinical, into the pharmaceutical or medical device industry. And my answer is always like a hard and fast, no, you don't. But when someone is hearing this, they probably are thinking, well, you did it to your fellowship. So of course, what would you say?
So I would say, yes, the fellowship obviously helped me because it sort of was a fellowship in training for running phase one and phase two studies. But is it necessary? No, apps. I would completely agree with you. Most of my colleagues that I work with and most of the colleagues I've worked with my whole career in product development have not done additional training. I did it because I really loved pharmacology. So if you love clinical pharmacology and think that's something you really like, then sure, go for it. But is it necessary? Absolutely not. No, would completely agree with you.
Yeah, super to know, because I think a lot of people, much of drug development seems like a mystery to a lot of our clinical colleagues, and and it is, right? But you learn a lot on the job. I think a lot of people worry that they need to learn before the job. So, so that's interesting. And people will also assume that they have had to have prior research experience, which clearly you did a lot of that in the Army, and you were a PI and so forth. But in your experience with your other colleagues, and even now, as I understand, the many opportunities you've had to hire and grow your own teams, is that an important piece of background for you for safety physicians?
I mean, it's important. I think it's similar to anything else like we talk about, like doing a fellowship, additional training. Yes, it's important. Like if two patients are equal and one has clinical research experience, that's important. But is it critical and is it necessary? No. I think for us, at least in the drug safety world, we are much more interested and we are much more looking for people to have the clinical experience. So, you know, can you look at data, a bunch of clinical data, and be able to suss out what's really going on here? What is the clinical picture? What type of adverse event are these patients having? And are there things that we can do to mitigate them, monitor for them? You know, and that comes with having clinical experience. That is, for us, more important, I think, than just the clinical research background. It's important because there's an awful, as you probably know, there's an awful lot about drug safety and pharmacovigilance that there are a lot of rules and a lot of regulations, and they differ from country to country. And so it's just stuff that practicing physicians usually have no idea about. And coming into drug safety, you don't either. And it just comes from years of experience. So that is important, but it's not critical. So I wouldn't advise people looking to get into drug safety that don't have any research experience. I would not say don't bother applying, because we certainly have brought people onto our team that don't have that experience, but have lots of clinical experience, and they've excelled in the role.
That's super. I know people are always wondering, you know, where can they learn more? Yeah. Where can they learn more? Where can they educate themselves so that they can sound informed, even though, of course, they may be novices, that they can at least sound informed in a in a screening or in an interview or even in a networking conversation. But since, of course, at least in my experience, it was really hard to understand what physicians do in pharma until I was actually doing it. I sort of had a leap of faith that I would enjoy it when I was considering it. And of course, I do. But can you tell people maybe a little bit more in a concrete way? What's the crux of your job? What do you do?
Yeah, that's maybe the biggest question I get from most people is what's the day-to-day like in drug safety? And of course, as you know, it's probably the same in your job in Med Affairs. It varies. I mean, there's no single day that's the same. But if I were to sort of amalgamate everything together and sort of give an average day, what my day consists of, I'd probably say, you know, there's usually a good 3 to 4 hours of just meetings. And that can include team meetings where there's like 30 people on the call or in a room from various functions, whether it's my function, drug safety, clinical development, regulatory, statistics, you know, all the different functions that go into a development team, those meetings all the way to like one-on-one meetings. So whether it's a meeting with my manager or a meeting with one other function because we want to strategize about something, those types of meetings, usually, you know, scheduled on the calendar, blocked off, maybe about 4 hours. The rest of the day is sort of spent, you know, doing the catching up on emails, reading is a big part of what we do in drug safety, reading and writing. We're responsible for a lot of reports that need to go into health authorities, whether they're periodic reports, monitoring the safety of our clinical trials, listings of adverse events that occur, things like that, looking over the data, making sure that we're doing the signal management, looking to make sure if new potential adverse reactions are popping up in our studies and assessing those. And so that requires a lot of like literature review and just reading about mechanisms of action of drugs and things like that. So I'd say the bulk of my day is spent doing a lot of reading and writing. But that's an average day. And then, of course, interspersed throughout that can be traveling to conferences or face-to-face meetings with partners or teams. If you're on a team that's a global, Roche, like your company, we're a global company. So sometimes we have meetings with our colleagues in different countries. A little bit less often for us in drug safety, probably, than for Med Affairs, but we do still travel from time to time. So that's interspersed throughout. But that's an average day. And I know this question also comes up too, and I'm sorry if I preempt you a little bit.
No, go ahead.
they'll always ask, like, is it always a 9 to 5 or 8 to 5 type, like Monday through Friday? For the most part, yes. But, so most of my weekends are free. It's different from clinical medicine in that respect. However, as you well know, when health authorities have questions, requests for information, or you're in the middle of a filing or something like that, your time is the company's time. And if the FDA or EMA or some other health authority has a question and they really need it answered, the team comes together and exhaustively tries to answer their questions. And so that can take a lot of time. It's definitely been a much better lifestyle in pharma than it was in clinical practice. But I don't want folks to think that coming to pharma is a sort of going out to pasture and enjoying the sun, riding off into the sunset. You will work hard. There will be times when you'll work very hard. And so just to let people know that still exists, but it's just much rarer, I think.
Yeah. And I think part of that may be, of course, some of it is related to the cycle and whether or not you're in the middle of a filing. But the other, I think, is perhaps more relevant to the work that you're doing. I mean, I think everybody recalls, as an example with COVID, that when there were any concerns, safety concerns about the trials, they came to a stop. And of course, that all hit the news. But those were things that those companies wanted to evaluate and manage both quickly and correctly, right?
Yeah. Yes. And I mean, everybody does, right? I mean, that's patient safety is such a huge, huge thing for drug development. We are, we want to make sure just as much as the health authorities do that the drugs that we're testing in clinical trials are first beneficial, of course, and actually have efficacy. But we don't want to hurt people either. So, I mean, of course, we want to make sure they're very safe. And so, yes, we are often, as a safety physician, you're often in the thick of these discussions because you're the one that knows the data the best and can answer the questions quickly.
Yeah. And I think if there is a such thing as an emergency in pharma, it's probably lives, closer to your sphere than many of the others. So, that's interesting because I do hear that question a lot. Do you need malpractice insurance or like people calling you all night? I mean, I have never been called at night or on the weekend, but except for a weekend where we had a medicine that was, imminently expected to have approval from the FDA and everybody wanted to be, first to hear that news, right?
Yeah.
So can you, So some people who are listening to this are saying, okay, so you're having meetings and then you're reading and writing stuff. And that might sound super appealing to some people and it might sound kind of dry to others, but I know you are not a dry guy. Like what about pharmacovigilance or drug safety is exciting to you?
So I think that sort of like yes, I am more outgoing and extroverted. I like talking to people, but I think that's why I like pharma, because even though, yes, the safety function, probably if you were to like put all the different jobs that a physician can have in pharma on a spectrum of extrovert to introvert, the safety physician is probably more toward the introvert. I think there's plenty of introverts that can do very well in drug safety if they really just like to look at data and things like that. And I am a scientist, like most physicians. I'm a scientist. I like science. I'm a scientist. I enjoy these types of things. So I do like to get into the data and look around as well. That part of my brain is satisfied very much with what I do. But I think working for a large pharma company, you are also sort of forced to interact with other functions. You can't say even safety, even like the really heavy data analytic functions within a pharma company, like statistics and drug safety and all of that, and biomarkers and, you know, whatever have you, the real, you know, bread and butter scientist folks, even they can't exist just in the lab. I mean, you have to be able to communicate what you know and communicate your field to people, to everybody on the team, so that good decisions can be made with all of the data. And so I like that part of it. I like being able to be on these cross-functional teams and talking to people of varied backgrounds and learning the science from people that are actually doing it on the bench. And from the physicians that are actually seeing the patients and just interacting with all those people. So even though, yes, there's a lot of, you know, sitting at a desk and reading and writing, there's a lot of interaction with people too. So it's not like you're just holed up in some room somewhere, you know, reading all day long.
Yeah. And of course, this is not what I do for a living, but of my colleagues in safety, the way that they have described to me, it sounds really very like investigative, like you're sort of detective work when there is a signal that you need to explore to find out, how meaningful is this? And is it even related to the medicine? Is that fair?
That's very fair. Yep. That's a big part of what we do is it's actually called signal seeking and analysis and validation and all of that. So we pour through the data, looking to see if there are signals that are popping up. And that occurs throughout the life cycle. That's not just where I work in early development. Of course, it probably sounds sort of intuitive. Of course, that's what we do. But even when a drug has been on the market for years, pharmaceutical companies have a mandate and a desire, obviously. Just because a drug is approved doesn't mean we know everything about it. And so we also want to make sure that we're still learning as the drug is out in market. And so the pharmacovigilance drug safety apparatus is throughout that entire lifespan. And so there are people working on drugs that have been approved for 20 years that are still collecting information from physicians and patients and health authorities and assessing signals and validating them. And we update the labels for drugs, even when they've been out for years. That's a big part of what we do. So yes, it is kind of like investigative work.
It's so important because it might seem obvious, but if people haven't stopped to think about it, they may not have thought about it, that when you're developing a medicine from scratch, especially if it's a new class of medicine, it doesn't come with its own warning labels. Like you're discovering that essentially from scratch, or perhaps based on informed guesses, based on the chemical structure and so forth.
Yeah.
But when the commercial plays and all of the things to look out for happen in the middle, someone has to figure that out. And that lies with drug safety. Yes.
Yeah. Actually, it's funny. A lot of my friends from medical school that don't know much about pharma ask what I do now. And my sort of quick and dirty answer to them, if they really, you know, aren't interested really in knowing more about it, if it's just, you know, the cocktail party or something, I'll just say, I'm the one that writes the list that you hear on the drug commercials. There's obviously a lot more what we do, but that you're right. That is a big part. When you first get a molecule, you go through a lot of literature research to think, well, is this a class of molecule that's been in the clinic before? What did we see when it was in the clinic with people in terms of adverse events? What have we seen from our preclinical work, our toxicology studies in animals, the chemical structure? Do we expect, you know, certain side effects to happen? And we build this sort of safety profile, what we think the drug is going to look like. And we build our phase 1 studies around making sure we're monitoring for that, making sure, you know, and we have discussions with health authorities to make sure they agree that everything we're doing is appropriate and safe for first in human studies. But yeah, like you said, it doesn't come with a manual. You know, you have to build that as you go and you learn, and it never stops. I mean, I think most physicians listening in are probably very familiar with drugs that have been pulled off the market 5-10 years into, you know, post-marketing and things like that. So it keeps going. It's definitely a life cycle learning process.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, if this doesn't sit in your shop, but not just adverse events, but also interactions with other medicines. Mm-hmm. Is that right? That's part of your remit.
That's part of our remit. And it's also that's where we, and that's probably where I you know, had a good niche in safety. It's also a remit of clinical pharmacology. You know, there's a lot of things that can impact drug-drug interactions, as we all know as physicians, you know, cytochrome P450 system, the transporters, food effects, things like that. That's all kind of the remit of the clinical pharmacologist, but we work very closely with clinical pharmacologists. They help figure out, you know, sort of why drug-drug interactions happen and how we can make them better. And we kind of help with what do we do about them and how can we, you know, it sort of all goes together for mitigating, and how do we describe it in the label and make sure that the physicians prescribing the drug know all of this information and are able to safely prescribe the drug.
Yeah, that's so important. I know a lot of people don't necessarily pay as much attention to the label as they should or the prescribing information. When I think about the significance of this, it's not always, you know, is these drugs going to hurt you, but also how do they work and where might they show up really unexpectedly, where the work that has been done by the pharmaceutical company in trying to educate physicians around it becomes really important because it's not always obvious where that might show up.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's not always a side effect like we think of. Like that might not be the most detrimental thing to the patient. It could be the social aspects or any of the downstream effects or drug-drug interactions that can really be the up. So you're right. All of that is very important to be able to communicate accurately and well so that people know.
Yeah. Well, while we're talking about a little bit of the difference between clinical pharmacology and the drug safety, I know a lot of people ask questions about, you know, different terms are used sometimes in different companies, and you've had a handful of these, and I see people asking, you know, what is the difference between being a pharmacovigilance physician versus a medical monitor or some of the others? Words that people either assume are synonyms or that really are. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. So yeah, there's, so first of all, I think people get confused because, you know, in the pharma world, you know, most large pharma companies are corporations, and, you know, we have a lot of sort of corporate speak in addition to medical speak and stuff. And so one of those, I think, is the titles versus like your job. So yeah, as you know, in most physician-centered areas, whether it's drug safety or clinical development or med affairs, we are all known as like medical directors or senior medical directors. That's just a title. So it's not like, you know, as a senior medical director, other senior medical directors in clinical development and med affairs, the three of us would not do the same thing from day to day. It's just our title's the same. It doesn't have to do with our job. Things like medical monitor and clinical development lead and med affairs lead, those are more jobs, more roles, sort of what you're doing. So you're hired as a medical director as your title, but your day-to-day job depends more on the field. So just to make sure there's clarity there, that you can be both a medical monitor and a medical director. Those are not mutually exclusive. In terms of some of the other sort of terms that we hear, one that I think is sort of confusing to folks is this idea of pharmacovigilance versus drug safety. They are synonymous, but there's also kind of a little bit of a difference. Pharmacovigilance is technically, it's the monitoring of drugs after they're approved. So it's the drug safety sort of drugs in the post-marketing phase, versus like drug safety, which is more in the clinical development world. But they all sort of fall under the remit of drug safety. Drug safety, like I said before, it spans the whole life cycle of the drug. So it's perfectly fine to use them. And a lot of pharmaceutical companies use them as synonyms. And I tell people I'm a pharmacovigilance physician. You know, it's sort of all blurred together there. The other one is this sort of idea of medical monitor. So medical monitors are usually, they're the physician that's sort of in charge from a sponsor side, from the pharmaceutical company side of a clinical trial. So if the investigator, so the physician that's actually treating the patients in a clinical trial, has a question about something and wants to talk to another physician, it's the medical monitor on the sponsor side that they would usually communicate with. There's also medical monitors that will get involved with studies. If we're having a CRO, a contract research organization, help us with the study, they'll sometimes supply medical monitors as well. We defer to the investigator for the clinical treatment of the patients because they're the ones on the ground seeing the patient. But if there's, you know, if they want questions about like, have you seen, you know, this in other patients, what drugs have worked for helping with some of these side effects, things like that, then the medical monitor would usually have that discussion with them. So that's sort of what a medical monitor does.
People ask about that a lot. And in terms of whether a medical monitor is actively practicing and whether they need malpractice insurance and so forth. My impression is, generally speaking, like you said, the actual care of the patient is with the PI and the physician who is caring for the patient. The medical monitor is just providing information and perhaps educating that person so they can make the best decision. So a monitor wouldn't necessarily carry malpractice or have any liability at all within with that patient's well-being, right?
Nope. Because ultimately we will not, no medical monitor will tell a physician treating a patient that they have to do X, Y, or Z. They will simply remind them that the protocol would say, you know, this is what the protocol says, but you are seeing the patient, what your clinical judgment trumps all. It might end up in a protocol deviation or something like that, but that, those, you know, that if the investigator, they're the ones treating the patient. So they're the ones that we would defer the medical judgment to. So yes, in general, medical monitors, safety physicians, people working within pharma, we are experts on the drug and the protocol. But we don't make clinical decisions for individual patients. And so we don't need to carry liability insurance.
It's such a common question. It's interesting. Okay, well, let me transition if I could. Oh, I'm sorry. Any other ones that you feel like are synonyms, or are there other buckets in drug safety?
One other one that I do see from time to time, just so folks are aware, and different companies might call them different things, but there's this idea of like the safety or clinical scientist versus the medical director. So I do see that a lot, because people will say like, oh, I applied for this safety scientist job, but the salary was way lower than I was expecting. Or, you know, there's a whole, you know, it's not just the physicians that are working.
Right.
Development or safety. You know, we need a lot of people to be monitoring the data and help us with things. So we do have safety scientists that work with us, which sometimes they're physicians, but sometimes they're PharmDs or PhDs. You know, they usually have some clinical background as well, but they're not usually physicians. And they help with sort of writing the documents and compiling the data. But ultimately, there's a safety physician that usually is the one that will kind of review the data and make clinical judgments about it, along with the clinical development lead. And on the clinical development side, they have the same. They have clinical scientists that, again, they're PharmDs, PhDs, sometimes physicians, and they have a lot of experience writing protocols and stuff. So just to be aware that when you're looking at jobs in pharmaceutical companies, not everything posted in safety science or clinical science is a physician job. So just be aware of that.
Yeah, that's a great point. And sometimes it can be hard to tell from a job listing, but you know, clearly if a requirement is to be a physician, right, to have an MD degree or to be board certified or so forth, then you can be pretty well assured that that's appropriate. But if you see something that's more general, like a physician or doctoral level other degree, that's still fair game for folks who are trying to get a foot in the door to apply, wouldn't you say?
I would. And those are, yes, of course, anything's fair game. I mean, like I say, technically a physician can apply for any job they're qualified for. So if a job asks for some clinical experience but doesn't specify MD, yeah, you're definitely qualified for it. You might not get the pay that you think you're going to get, but it's definitely, you know, you're qualified for it. And where these types of jobs are also useful is, this comes up every now and then on these types of forums, people that didn't finish a residency or do a residency, they might have just done medical school and graduated. It would be very difficult to get a medical director role if you don't have clinical experience, like hands-on, like residency training. To jump right to a medical director role, whether it's drug safety or clinical development, that would be difficult. But you could, and that this is an area where I sometimes tell people they can look at safety science and clinical science with an MD, but no residency training. That's a possibility. That's something that they could consider. And like you said, get a foot in the door kind of and work your way up from there. I have worked with plenty of safety medical directors who did not do a residency, but almost universally, people that get to that level without doing a residency usually come with like 5 or 10 years of pharma experience, not in a medical director role, versus people that we take from the clinic usually have done residency training at least, and have some clinical experience. So yes, it's definitely all that is to say that there are many, many roads to get to pharma for people with medical training, for sure.
That's a great point. Because people do ask that question a lot.
Yeah.
let me ask you some things that might sound like a little more soft, but I always think are important, because whenever I'm advising somebody about, you know, exploring the different careers, I'm telling them, go meet people who are doing that and find out what they like about it and also what they don't like about it, so you can think about whether or not you would like it. So when you think, I mean, you've told us what your day-to-day is like, but can you tell us maybe like the thing you love the most about your work, and then possibly, and of course Genentech's not listening, what you maybe don't love as much, so sure, people can know what's the highs and what's the lows?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to narrow down any one thing that I love about. I think maybe perhaps the thing I love the most is that, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning of talking, one of the reasons why I never really loved being in the clinic was I just felt like I wasn't really making a huge impact across the board. Yes, every now and then I'd have a patient that would come in with something I could fix, you know, right away. But most of the time it's things that if patients aren't compliant, or they're, you know, it's something that you can give medicines to help with, but it's not going to, like, you know, high blood pressure, or liver disease, things like that. I just never felt like I was making a huge impact across the board. In pharma, I feel like I'm doing that. I mean, it's like a drug gets approved and it's helping thousands, hundreds of thousands of people sometimes. Yeah. And it's just such a good feeling to know that there's, like, you know, and one of the things Genentech does, which I love this, is they invite patients that are directly impacted by our drugs to come and talk to us for various events. And it just gives you such a great feeling to see, like, these families, people that are just completely transformed by the drugs that we've worked so hard on. And that just gives you a really good feeling. And I love that. Yeah. I feel like I'm really using my medical experience, but also, like, get to just everything I've changed for in my life, I get to use. And I love that aspect of it.
Yeah, I know people can't see, but you're, like, so smiling and glowing right now. I can really feel how much you mean that. It's and I share that. It's absolutely an amazing feeling. And it is a big scale, right? It's a big scale of impact. So that's cool. Okay. What about maybe the flip side?
I mean, again, there's not a lot. I love what I do. I think I would do this until Roche forces me to retire, or, you know, I have to for some other reason. Like, I love going to work. I love the people I work with. I love what we do. I mean, if there's any criticism, it's just sometimes we work too hard. I mean, it's like, there's, you're probably the same at your company. I mean, these people were so dedicated to the mission and sort of what we're doing. Our managers are all very supportive of us taking, you know, the time off and being away and recharging and all that. But I think it's just the fact that most of us don't want to. Most of us just want to, like, keep going. And it's just, I guess as I'm saying this, I'm realizing that's not even really something I guess I hate. So it's, yeah. It's hard. It's hard to really nail down something I don't like about it. I think, like, most of us in pharma, we have stumbled upon something that if you really love it, it's like we've stumbled upon a gold mine. I mean, like, we're helping patients, we're using our scientific backgrounds, our medical backgrounds, we're doing everything that I think most of, you know, that we want to do to help people. And it's great.
So when I think about, you were talking about, you know, when people are looking for jobs, like what kind of jobs to look for and so forth. And of course, when many of our colleagues look at job postings, those documents are like 2 pages long, and they have so many requirements of all the things you're supposed to know how to do and all the things you're supposed to be. And generally, I view these as extremely aspirational, right? Like, nobody's all of those things, or at least that's my view. I wonder if you could comment on not only whether you agree with me there or not, but also what are the just couple of things that you think are really the most important skills if someone's interested in drug safety, that they should have, that they should bring that to the table?
That's a great question. So first of all, I completely agree with you. You actually said, like, look, if you fit every single description in the job description to a T and you had everything they were looking for, you'd be you'd be applying to be that person's boss. Like, so
that's right.
But I think that's such a great, like, in a nutshell, just how aspirational these job descriptions really are. I mean, certain things are necessary. You need to have the medical background, all that is necessary. But yes, in terms of, like, fitting the bill, you're not going to find somebody to apply to a associate medical director job that has 10 years of pharma experience, has, you know, all this X, Y, and Z stuff. I mean, you're just not. So
yeah,
definitely don't be dissuaded if you don't have any direct pharma experience from applying to a job if they ask for something like, 2 to 4 years probably of experience. That's kind of aspirational, but be smart about it too. I mean, the other thing I see sometimes are people that might be at a certain level in their clinical career, like they're a department chief or something, or, chief of medicine or chief of surgery or something. And they think that that will translate directly to like a VP or SVP role, a vice president or senior vice president role at a pharma company. There, I think you need to be careful, because those levels, they definitely need to have some experience in pharma. And so it's not likely that that will translate very well. So just be aware, if it says 2 to 4 years experience, fair game. If it says 5, 10 years experience or more, or, leading teams, that you might really need to have some direct experience either with clinical trials. I mean, certainly people from academia that have run clinical trials for years or are PIs and, overseeing a lab with multiple research projects, that's different because you have experience doing clinical research there. But if you're a department chief of like a clinic, not doing clinical research, just be aware that you apply for jobs with 2 to 4 years experience, but maybe not the VP level. Other than that, I think it's really the biggest skills I think that folks can bring to the table and things you really want to highlight are working in a multifunctional or matrix environment where you are part of the team. I think that's a huge skill. That's a big part of what we do in pharma. We're working with a whole bunch of other functions, and being able to, you're not the one, it's not up to you. You're not the one making the calls on everything. You're giving your input from your function. You have to be able to persuade people if you feel strongly about something, but at the end of the day, it might be the project team lead or the clinical development lead or the company itself, if it's a much larger decision, that's making the decision. And you have to be okay with working as part of a team and not like the head of a team. I think that's very important. And then the one thing I always tell people, this took me a while to get used to, especially coming from like most of us probably trained under a Socratic method of medicine where, we all went to morning report, at least in internal medicine, we went to morning report and we were grilled relentlessly by our attendings until, you get an answer wrong. And then that's what you're, shamed into going to study later. So you sort of develop this thick skin about appearing like you don't know something. Get over that in pharma. ask questions. Don't be afraid to be that person that, holds the meeting a little bit longer because you want to really get something clear. Don't be afraid to think you sound stupid, because it's cliche to say. I mean, obviously, when you ask a question, everybody in the room probably is thinking the same thing. But just get over that fear and be able to do that, because that's, there's so much. Even if something seems simple, it's not usually. So just make sure that you can, function like that. I think those are really the key things that I look for when I'm interviewing people.
Yeah, I think that's important. And it's so interesting because, because there are so many different kinds of professionals within the industry and we're working together in these teams, there is no stupid question to be. I mean, there really isn't. Nope. Because not everybody is coming from the same knowledge base, right? So it's really just, have we thought about this way? Can someone help me think about it that way to be sure that we're doing a really good job and being thorough and considering everything? It's actually a value add to ask those questions, I think, rather than, how you might view it in traditional academics of exposing yourself for having not known something, right? I've never gotten that vibe. Yeah. Well, we've been chatting for a while. I think I've gotten most of the questions that are the common ones, at least the common ones that I hear. I think I've had a chance to ask them. Is there anything? Oh, wait. Oh, one more. I know that people will, actually, this is a two-parter. I have heard, and I don't want to make any generalizations. Every company is different. Every role is different. But I have heard people say that they think drug safety is conducive to remote work more than other functions. Maybe, I don't know if you can speak relatively compared to other functions, but maybe you could speak to that in general. Yeah. And I've also heard some say that drug safety is a easier sort of path for entry into industry in general, as compared to other functions. Yeah. I have no idea if that's true or not. What do you think?
Great, great questions. And yes, those do come up. Both of those come up for fairly frequently. So for the first question, remote work. I mean, I think the last couple of years have shown us that a lot of what we can do can be done remotely, whether it's drug safety or even clinical. I mean, obviously, the 2020 and 2021, we were all working remotely and still going forward. I mean, obviously, the biggest success probably in recent history of drugs getting approved quickly happened while we were all working remotely. So, right. Yes, it can happen. And drug safety, I would say maybe it's a little bit more conducive to working remotely, but my personal feeling is probably not any more than any of the other functions that exist. I mean, obviously with like lab work and things like that, where you have to be in the lab doing bench work, that's different. But any of the roles that most physicians take, whether it's clinical development or drug safety, I don't think one is more conducive to remote working than the other. Right now my company does a hybrid where they want us to be in the office, about 50% or more of our time. But they're flexible on that. And I think that's a good balance. I like to be in the office usually about 3 days a week, just because I like the interaction, the personal interaction. You know, there's just something intangible about running into people. Yeah. And having conversations and stuff that you just can't do remotely. But can I do what I do remotely? Yes, I can. And I did for 2 years during COVID. So you could, and I know my company does consider hiring people remotely sometimes, but it's rare. We want people to be in the area because we want that personal interaction to happen too. But some companies I know do allow remote working for everybody, and that's fine. I think we can still do it. So if you're looking for a remote job, I think pharmacovigilance, drug safety is reasonable. But I think any job in a pharmaceutical company probably could be.
Is it easier? And I want to use air quotes there. Sure. Right? Obviously, nobody can see. Is it easier to get into pharmacovigilance as compared to other functions, do you think?
Okay, yeah, good question as well. Yes, and that depends as well. I think if you have more of a general background, like you're an internist or a pediatrician or an ER doc or something, I think probably pharmacovigilance, drug safety would be a little bit of an easier road. Because again, we're not looking for a specific background. You know, I work solely on oncology trials, but I'm not an oncologist. And nobody, actually one person I work with in my group is an oncologist. The rest of us, I'm an internist. My boss is an internist. Her boss is an ER doc. And we have, you know, on my team, we have an anesthesiologist. We have an ophthalmologist. We have a pediatrician. And we have an oncologist. But
there you go.
Yeah. So, yes, I think drug safety, there's definitely an avenue for folks that have more of a general background. And even people that are specialized can certainly do drug safety as well. For clinical development, they tend to want people with either a lot of development experience, or they have the background. So like an oncology, like all of the medical monitors and clinical development leads I work with, they're all oncologists. And same for like our neuro studies. Most of them are neurologists, our ID studies, most of them are ID docs. There is an exception there too. Like at this point in my career, you know, having worked in product development for the better part of 10 years, maybe a little bit more, I could probably apply. I mean, I do get recruiters and companies reach out about clinical development programs and oncology and things like that where I've worked. And so you could, after a while of getting experience, do that. But I think it's much easier for folks with a general background to sort of go into drug safety. Med affairs, I'll leave to you. I don't know much about med affairs, so I'll leave that part to you. But in terms of the clinical development, drug safety, yeah, I think probably drug safety is a little easier to get your foot in the door. But again, we really, really want people to have clinical experience. So just having the MD isn't enough. We want you to have the clinical experience as well.
Yeah, I think that's important. I mean, when I think generally, I mean, this is sweeping generalization, but generally speaking, you know, to start a career in the pharmaceutical industry, I feel like you either need to have, you know, demonstrated competence as a clinician. So you've been a physician for a while and you know clinical medicine, or you've done research, but probably not both. You know, or if when the clinical specialty becomes relevant, it's kind of like one of those three things has to ladder up. Like you either need to know what you're doing from a research point of view, but you know, you can learn the therapeutic area or the disease state, right? Or you need to know that, and then you can learn the research bit, or you need to have really solid clinical experience and you can learn the whole rest of the thing. If you have none of those three things, it's a hard sell. But if you have at least one, I feel like others can be learned.
Not unlike the job descriptions, aspirational, right? Like it's
right.
You're gonna find somebody with all of them. Yeah.
If you have some of those things, you're at least a viable candidate. And then I think, you know, to your point, I mean, once you have been in the work for a couple, more than a couple of years, I suppose, but for, you know, for a little while, then it becomes a whole lot less relevant what your clinical training was or what level of, you know, what amount of research you have, or to your example about the safety scientist, once you have experience doing the actual job, all of that kind of falls to the back. Yeah, I think.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, cool. This has been extremely informative. I know my audience is going to love every minute, learn a lot of it, and be really very enlightened to have heard a lot of the advice that you said. Is there anything else that you think people ought to know before we wrap?
No, I think this has been great. I'm happy to sort of, you know, be able to do this all at once. And I'm glad to hear that it's helpful for people. I think your program, this is the podcast and your materials are great. I think my biggest piece of advice for everybody, and I know you've done lots of podcasts on this, is the networking. Building the network is so important. I mean, it's just, it's cliche, but it just, most of us get our jobs from people that we know. And so in addition to everything that we've talked about today, you know, no one's just going to hand you a job. Like, just get out there, talk to as many people as you can, build that network, even if it's just to drop a note, you know, once every couple months. I mean, it's so important. So, I mean, I think that's the last piece of advice I would just give people.
Yeah. I feel like that cannot be overemphasized. I was speaking with a client just the other day who was expressing sort of frustration because she had been talking to a lot of people that I put her in touch with. And she sort of said, well, yeah, but all of them got jobs from people that they knew. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, but they didn't know them before. Like, they didn't know them when they first started on this, you know, adventure to try to pivot. They didn't know them first. They went deliberately to get to know people.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's sort of like when the job falls out of the sky, well, there was a whole lot of groundwork that was laid in advance of that, right?
Yeah, I think that's a key. Yeah, I remember having a conversation with somebody the other day too, kind of along the same lines. And I think it's important to know that when we say network and get to know people, we don't mean be their best friends or like having worked with them for 15 years. And like, you know, I think you and I at this point would consider each other in our networks, like, and we've met and talked to each other, you know, a handful of times. That's fine. When I got my job at Genentech, even with my background, it was through people that I networked with. It was through somebody that I met at a ClinPharm conference and had mentioned I was interested in moving to San Francisco. And he put me in touch with a bunch of folks at Genentech, and the rest was history. So, I mean, it's important to just be able to know that when we say people that we know, we don't mean these are like our best friends that we've known forever. Right. Spend Christmases with them and everything. It's really just those, you know, the connections of having a 20-minute conversation with somebody once every 6 months or so, or just, you know, we follow them on LinkedIn and you see what they're up to and you reach out to them every now and then, say congratulations on the new job, how's everything going, little things like that. That's what we mean by the network. So don't feel that just because you don't have 20 absolute best friends in pharma, that doesn't mean you don't have an extensive network. Most people have more extensive networks than they really even know.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think most physicians just don't use LinkedIn until they are thinking about an industry career. But within the industry, everybody does. And of course, you can also have personal, you know, interpersonal networking. But that's a place where they do a lot of that heavy lift for you because they suggest to you, hey, here's people you went to college with or medical school with or a friend of your friend. You know, they help you to know who you might be able to reach out to. And it's easy to build, even if you don't have really anybody that comes to mind today, it's pretty easy to build that out.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that because I do think that's really important. People seem to think of when they hear the word networking versus, you know, what we really mean, I suppose. maybe they're different. But yeah, it's those sort of loose connections, right? People that you, I mean, they're acquaintances. They're not besties.
Right? Exactly.
For the most part.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. So everybody in, you know, the business world, that's how things move. That's how things
happen. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks again, Patrick. This is really, really super. We've got a lot that we covered, but I really appreciate it. I think people are going to come away from this knowing a lot more, not only about drug safety, but also just about the pharmaceutical industry in general. So what a great episode. Thank you so much for sharing all your insight.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Before you go, please review, share, and subscribe to this podcast. Your support makes all the difference, and it truly helps this information reach someone just like you who may really need it. Until next time, thanks for listening.